I believe there's a lesson here for the Trump administration. Don't try to change the rules by breaking the rules. This preliminary injunction reaffirms that nobody, not even the President of the United States, is above the law. Just like every one of us here, just like the Dreamers, all of us in this country are expected to obey the law.
California Attorney General Javier Becerra crowing about his win in federal court last night. A district judge issued a nationwide injunction against the Trump administration's plans to shut down the DACA program. It's temporary. It lasts only as long as the state's legal challenge, unless there's some other action. And while the Dreamers are getting a break, others are not as lucky. The Trump administration has ended deportation protection for around 300,000 people from El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Haiti. And that's not to mention the untold numbers of people who are turned away at the border or the hundreds of thousands deported every year. So what happens to people who are forced to return to their home countries, especially those who could end up in serious danger or killed? Sarah Stillman tried to find an answer to that question. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and director of the Global Migration Program at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. She learned that for some, deportation is a death sentence. Sarah Stillman joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So we talked a lot about President Trump's actions there, but his predecessor, President Barack Obama, was known as the deporter in chief for his policies. So the stories that you profile, that you look into in this New Yorker story, they were originated under Obama's administration, correct?
Right. Well, they really spanned both administrations. So this project was originally conceptualized back under Obama, when I realized that despite attempts to create comprehensive immigration reform, when that didn't come through, Obama was still deporting many people who had come here fleeing pretty serious gang violence in Central America's Northern Triangle region, so El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And many of those people were, in fact, being sent back to their death, not just hypothetically, but actually in cases that me and my whole team at Columbia University sought to document. But I think we should certainly underscore that under the Trump administration, we're seeing a massive expansion of the categories of people who are suddenly deportable.
Right. And for people who don't have legal protections, who are undocumented, you tell the story, you illustrate with the story of Laura. She was a Mexican immigrant living in South Texas, and she was deported back in 2009. And often she and many others are deported, or they're arrested, I should say, for seemingly minor infractions. And that, of course, ends up changing everything.
Exactly. So that's exactly what happened to Laura. She had been living in Texas for most of her adult life, and she had very deep roots there. She had U.S. citizen children, was working in a restaurant, and one day she was driving home from work late in the evening, and she was pulled over for a minor traffic violation, driving between two lanes. And then the cop wound up inquiring about her immigration status, which was not conventional at the time, but is becoming more and more required oftentimes under Trump. And when the cop learned that she was undocumented, he decided to call Border Patrol to the scene. And this woman pleaded for her life both to the cop and then to Border Patrol, saying, "I've got a violent ex-spouse in Mexico. He's been threatening to kill me back in Reynosa. Please, please do not deport me. Give me time to show you the emergency protective order I have. Give me a chance to make my case." Instead, she was deported that very same night. Her last words to Border Patrol were, "When I am found dead, it will be on your conscience." And in fact, the very next week, she was found incinerated in her car back in Mexico.
And indeed, she had thought her ex was going to come after her, and he did. And he was actually convicted of her murder later.
That's exactly right. So he, in fact, had wound up strangling her and killing her. And then to add another twist to the story that makes this particularly relevant to the Trump era, she found that after she was murdered, her cousin had testified in the murder trial. Her cousin is a DACA recipient who just recently, in December, lost her DACA status. She's been getting death threats as a result of testifying against this man, and now she faces potential deportation to her death as well.
Mm-hmm. And so was there some question of whether or not Laura was coerced into signing away her rights and voluntarily going back to Mexico?
Yes. So we documented a range of cases, some people who came here and directly presenting themselves at ports of entry and who were turned back. In Laura's case, since she'd been living here for quite some time, she was not subject to something known as expedited removal, where they can instantaneously deport you. But she was pressured by Border Patrol to sign off on what was known as voluntary removal. So, you know, they were alleging that it was a voluntary decision to go back to this country that she was pleading and crying and begging not to be sent back to. And she was very clear that her life was in danger. And we have protections in the U.S. against that. And in fact, we have both international and domestic laws that say that no one should ever be sent back to a situation where they could be killed or tortured.
And Border Patrol is supposed to ask them, right? Do you fear for your life or do you fear that you will be persecuted in some way if you're returned?
Exactly. So Border Patrol is not meant to be the arbiter of those decisions. In fact, they are required when they apprehend someone at the border to ask them that question, do you fear for your life if you are returned? And then if the person says yes, again, they don't adjudicate. They push them along to an asylum officer, a very trained individual who is meant to vet them. And we do have a very rigorous vetting process. And then they may get a chance to see an immigration judge and make their case. Although increasingly what you're seeing is the prevalence of what's known as summary removals. So more than 80% of the deportations we have now are people who never got a chance to go before a judge, never got a chance to make their case or have their story heard.
And is that because the Border Patrol, they're not asking that question, so they're not putting them into that pool to have their cases heard later?
It's actually a range of reasons. So some of it is certainly Border Patrol, and there have been studies by the ACLU and some bipartisan organizations that have shown that in upwards of 50% of cases, Border Patrol allegedly did not even ask the rudimentary questions that they are required to ask about whether people fear harm if deported. But then there's also a whole range of other reasons, too, including the fact that oftentimes immigration judges don't even have an easy way to grant these people asylum because our asylum laws haven't always recognized that people fleeing gang violence from Central America qualify for those sorts of protections.
Yeah, and so you profile a woman named Elena who came up against that. Can you talk a little bit about her story?
So Elena came from Honduras, and she had a younger brother who had been murdered for being gay, killed by the gangs. She had a sister who had been coerced and raped by a gang member and then murdered. And finally, she decided it was just too dangerous to stay, and she decided to flee to the U.S. And when she got to the border, she presented herself. She declared her fear of return. And instead, the Border Patrol officer wrote on the paperwork that she did not fear return. So when she was in detention, she actually protested and got a rare second shot, which doesn't always happen. But in this case, she did get to go to an asylum officer and then got passed along to an immigration judge. But what she encountered in immigration court is what many, many people from Central America's Northern Triangle are facing right now, which is that she was able to articulate her fear. She was able to spell out the story of her family members being murdered in her paperwork with the asylum officer. But then the judge asked her only one question in a 2-minute interview where she's begging for her life. The judge asked, you know, did you try to go elsewhere before you came here? And she said no. And it turned out that that made her unqualified in this judge's regard for a shot at asylum. So she returned home. And in fact, she was immediately attacked by the man who had been threatening to kill her before. And she made one more journey back to the U.S. And this time she has received a status known as withholding of removal. So it's a precarious status. She doesn't have the safety and protection of asylum, but she is here now after she was subject to pretty traumatizing harms by the man who had threatened her before she was deported.
Well, it also seems from your story pretty arbitrary, you know, who gets deported and whether or not they get to stay in the country, depending on where, in fact, your immigration hearing is held. So if you're in a state like California or New York, you might have better luck than if you're like someplace like, I don't know, South Carolina.
Absolutely. It's a total roll of the dice. And geography plays a really big role in that. So we've seen that people in New York, as you just mentioned, or California have decent grant rates. And you might take that same exact fact pattern and apply it in a place like Atlanta, Georgia, and see a grant rate that I think hovers around 5%. So incredibly low grant rates in certain parts of the country, even with near identical cases. So that's a huge issue, as is just the total lack of access to counsel for many of these people. So if you're in a detention facility far away from a major U.S. city, the odds that you will find representation are very slim. And we have literally had 3-year-olds appearing before immigration judges in court by themselves without representation. And we've had judges who've said, you know, 3-year-olds should be able to represent themselves in court. Hmm. And of course, that has a huge a huge impact on their ability to get asylum. And they've seen dramatically different grant rates based on who has representation and who does not.
Yeah. So you've been trying to come up with this database of people who are deported to their deaths. And first of all, the United States does not collect that information, I understand. And so how hard was it to be able to determine that number?
Gosh, I mean, I think we only began to scratch the surface. So I worked with a team. I run something called the Global Migration Program at Columbia Journalism School. And I had a fantastic team of more than a dozen people working on this for more than a year. And we found upwards of 60 cases of people who had been sent back and then either killed or otherwise harmed. So sexually assaulted, kidnapped by drug cartels, extortion, all kinds of things. And I believe that that represents, again, only a tiny fraction of the number of people who actually face very serious harms after they're sent back, partly because many families are terrified to speak out. They really do face and have a credible fear of ramifications from the cartels or the gang members who killed their family or loved ones. And there's a whole host of other reasons as well. I mean, of course, these people are in regions where the U.S. government doesn't track them after their deportations, and it takes a lot of resources and a lot of time to be able to hunt down as many cases as one can. So that's certainly what we spent the last year doing, but I think there's many more stories to be told.
And there is a lawsuit now that's pending over the circumstances of Laura's death, the woman we began the segment talking about, and whether or not the United States has a responsibility to protect people like her from deportation. What is your assessment of this lawsuit and whether or not it will succeed, given, you know, the pretty conservative makeup of the Supreme Court?
Yeah, it's a huge uphill battle. And I've found looking at a number of cases where Border Patrol or other government agencies, particularly in the realm of immigration, were sued, it's pretty hard to get accountability. These are pretty non-transparent agencies, and government actors tend to have a lot of immunity in court. So I think that's been one of the many causal factors in leading to circumstances like Laura's death. And her case actually made it a good ways, given the case landed before an immigration judge, Andrew Hanen, who's quite notorious for having a hardline stance on immigration. He decried many of Obama's programs. And nonetheless, it made it past his initial radar. And he, in fact, said it was one of the sadder cases he'd seen and a really troubling one. But nonetheless, it was ultimately dismissed, and now it's working its way up the appeals court. But it's a tough road, and I don't know exactly what it'll hold, certainly, as you mentioned, given the Supreme Court we have right now.
Sarah Stillman is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where you can read her article. It's called When Deportation is a Death Sentence. She's also the director of the Global Migration Program at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Sarah, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yesterday, we talked about Republican Orange County Congressman Ed Royce retiring this year. Well, today, another embattled California Republican, Daryl Issa, has made the same announcement. Issa was first voted into Congress back in 2001 in a district that covers parts of San Diego and Orange counties. He is the wealthiest man in Congress, worth more than $760 million. Much of that fortune came from the Viper car alarm in the 1980s.
Viper arm. Protected by Viper. Stand back.
That is Issa's own voice saying, stand back. Well, for many years, he has easily made the Democrats stand back. He's won re-election in his conservative district. And he burnished his conservative credibility by tangling with Democrats when he was chair of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Once, during a hearing, he cut off ranking member Elijah Cummings' microphone when he didn't want to hear any more of what the Maryland Democrat had to say.
Mr. Chairman, you cannot run a committee like this. You just cannot do this. We're better than that as a country. We're better than that as a committee. I have asked for a few minutes to ask a procedural.
Now you're turning me off.
Okay, there he is. Off mic. Issa was a harsh critic of President Obama and Hillary Clinton. He spearheaded numerous investigations, including the investigation into the Benghazi attacks. In December of last year, he told Fox News that the Clinton email case should be reopened.
Obviously, Hillary Clinton was not held accountable for lying. Lois Lerner was not held accountable for lying. It's that double standard calls into question the investigation and the decisions by former Director Comey as to whether Hillary Clinton committed crimes, which I believe she did, and should be prosecuted for them.
But in last year's election, ISA won by a super slim margin, about 1,600 votes, and Hillary Clinton easily carried his district. Democrats had targeted ISA as one of the vulnerable seats they want to flip in their effort to win back the House this year. Several hundred protesters gathered outside his local office last May to protest his vote to get rid of Obamacare.
Daryl ISA, hear us shout. We are going to vote you out. Daryl ISA, hear us shout. We are going to vote you out.
After that, ISA began dodging reporters, including us. Press Play has asked for an interview many, many times, but he has never made an appearance. Politico reporter Rachel Bade tweeted, "I just asked at Daryl ISA about the Comey news, and he flicked me off, literally gave me the middle finger and kept walking, said nothing." Well, lately, Republicans had included Daryl ISA in what they call the Patriot Program. That's a special fundraising operation to help save endangered GOP incumbents. Well, that won't be necessary anymore, because after 16 years in Congress, Daryl ISA is standing back.
Viper arm. Protected by Viper. Stand back.
Coming up, an incredible survival story from a woman who barely made it out of the Montecito mudslides. She did it by clinging onto the branch of a tree. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Okay, we're going to turn to the situation in Montecito now, where search and rescue operations are still underway, and the community is getting a sense of just what happened. The mudslide that ran through part of the town early yesterday morning knocked houses off their foundations and sent boulders crashing through walls. The disaster is blamed for at least 15 deaths, and it has residents sharing stories of harrowing escapes. Kathy King is one of them. Her house was in an evacuation zone, but she was directly across the street from a voluntary evacuation zone. And so she says she and her family decided to stay and play it by ear.
We just have spent 10 days in December evacuated from our house. And
then that was for the fires, right?
Yes, for the Thomas fire in December. So for this one, we figured we're a stone's throw from the voluntary zone. We don't live near any sort of tributary or seasonal creek or anything that's going to flood. So we decided to stay, but we didn't really go to sleep. We packed our cars. We faced them to the street. We went to sleep for a little while. We woke up about 2, and then at about 3:30, the sky went orange, as if the sun had come out, only kind of like it looked during the fire, where it was just sort of this hazy glow, which you don't ever see in the middle of the night. It was extremely alarming and sort of apocalyptic. So
what was that? Why was it orange?
Well, we didn't know at the time, but we found out later that electrical transformers were blowing and a couple of houses caught fire. And so what we were seeing were blown transformers and house fires, and the first responders were unable to get to those homes. So the houses were burning out of control. And so that just looked alarming enough to us that we needed to get out. And so we got in 2 separate cars.
So in one car is you, and in the other car is your husband and your son.
Yeah. And my son's friend who was spending the night, who needed a place to stay.
And how old are they?
My son, Duncan, is 20, and his friend, Justin, I think is 19.
Uh-huh.
And we left the dog. And I got to Sheffield, and I decided not to get on the freeway, and I turned on Jamison, which is the frontage road. And that was like the edge of the voluntary evacuation zone, Jamison. So I'm on the frontage road.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I got to a stop sign getting towards San Ysidro Road, I noticed a big van in front of me turning around. And I thought, well, if the van can't get through that intersection, I'm not going to in my Prius C. So I also turned around, and as I turned around, the road went from asphalt to a river. That fast, in seconds. My car was floating. I rolled down the window. I cracked the door, thinking I don't want to get trapped in this car. And I maneuvered with the current into a driveway that I saw between two pillars because I saw a carport, and I was trying to get the car backed in so that I could get some sort of safety. I didn't make it to the carport, but I made it to a tree that had branches sticking out of it. So as soon as I got wedged up against the tree, I squeezed out of my door and got on the roof of my car and grabbed onto the tree, because at that point, I didn't know how high the water was going to rise.
Oh, my gosh. And what's going through your mind at this point? You must have been panicked.
I was panicked. I felt better once I was had my arms around the tree, because I was recalling, you know, tsunami stories where people who were attached to trees were better off. And so that was going through my mind. I called 911 a few times and got either a busy signal or no response. I called my husband, of course, and was getting no response.
So your husband and the two young men, they are stuck as well, but there are authorities there who are helping them or do eventually help them get out.
Yeah. And so eventually I got through on the phone to I actually called my daughter, who lives in New York, and got through to her.
From the tree.
From the tree. I thought I might have to say goodbye. And in the meantime, she hung up for me. She was able to reach my husband, who then was able to call and got through to me. I told him where I was. He called his friend. Dave has a big four-wheel drive van. Dave drove down to the bottom of San Ysidro Road and found a fireman and relayed to him where I was. There was a neighbor out there who lived in that area also willing to help. And together they found some ladders, and they got on the roof of the house where I was next to, and made their way over to the roof of the carport where I was about 20 feet away in the tree, and called down to me. I could see their headlamps, and so I started yelling when I saw their headlamps where I was. They found me. They got to the roof of the carport, and then they went back and got the ladders, and they kind of used the ladders, kind of piggybacking, leapfrogging ladders, you know, two of them, till they could work the ladders over to me, because at that point there was probably 4 feet of water, and it was rushing pretty fast. And then together we made our way back over to the roof of the carport, went over that house, and then got down on the other side of that house where there was less water and probably about 3 feet of mud. And then my friend Dave and I went through the mud to his van, which was on higher, drier ground, and went to his house.
All right. So some of your friends were not as fortunate and were killed.
Yes.
Can you tell us what happened to them?
We have a very good friend, one of my husband's best friends, who lives in a similar area to us along East Valley Road, the 192, that was just inside the mandatory zone, maybe by yards. He and his 21-year-old daughter and his 19-year-old son were at home on the second floor of their house, and their entire street was obliterated. It's gone. My husband went up there yesterday to see if he could help with anything, because we'd heard a rumor they were missing. And the son and daughter were together, and they washed down the creek to another house of friends that we know, and the father and son at that house, they helped pull them out. And by that time, the young woman had bled to death, and the son was he was injured, and they took him to Cottage Hospital, where he's since been released. And the son of our friend who helped pull them out was also injured, and he is still at Cottage Hospital, but I think he's going to be fine. But we just heard of a good friend and a realtor that we had used who is confirmed dead, and I think there's going to be many more.
You know, a lot of the coverage that we're hearing that people were warned to evacuate and chose not to. And had people heeded authorities, perhaps there would have been fewer fatalities.
That's somewhat true, but I think the way they chose to frame the evacuations was, you know, mandatory to the 192 and voluntary below that, which is a different mindset. You know, for us, the mindset was we're 50 yards from elderly people who live in Burnham Wood, and they're not evacuating. You know, they're only in the voluntary. So it gives you a different sense. And so, I know, I think if the evacuations had been mandatory down to the beach, that would have been more accurate, because the vast majority of the destruction was in the lower area that was voluntary.
So you're saying that there was a problem there with the whole evacuation procedure.
As far as I believe, yes. And also you're dealing with a community that is experiencing some evacuation fatigue. You know, we were out of our home for 10 days in December for the Thomas fire. And, you know, at a certain point you just go, gosh, do I really want to go through that again? I know it's life and limb. And so you need to do what's right. But at the same time, when, like I said, people, you know, within feet of you are not being asked to go, it's a different sense than mm-hmm. if they say everybody needs to get out.
Yeah. So what about now? How is your house? And are you going back to it?
We can't get back in. There's an exclusion zone in basically all of Montecito. There are people that stayed that are on our street that have told us everything's fine. People are taking care of our dog. I don't know when we're going to get back in.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And wow. I'm very impressed with your story of survival, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you, Madeline, very much.
That's Kathy King of Montecito talking about the mudslides and flooding there. We'll continue to bring you updates on this story right here on KCRW. Coming up, how China is using surveillance to give each citizen a so-called social credit score.
If you have a low social credit score, you wouldn't be able to book first-class train travel. You potentially wouldn't be able to get a passport. And that is already happening.
The surveillance state on steroids, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In China, there's a new facial recognition program that's pushing the country toward what could be total surveillance. It's called Sharp Eyes. Cameras now in banks, airports, hotels, even public toilets. They track where you are, who you hang out with, what you're doing. And you get a so-called social credit score based on how trustworthy the government thinks you are. Simon Denyer recently reported on this. He's China bureau chief for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, there's actually just a pilot program going on right now. Tell us how it works.
At the moment, most streets in China are already covered by security cameras in the major cities anyway. You know, CCTV is pretty prevalent in the cities. But what this project is trying to do is really extend that much, much further. It's extending it into the villages. So there might be cameras at your compound. There might be cameras at your workplace checking who's going in and out. Integrating all of those cameras into one overarching system so that they know where everybody is all the time, where everybody's coming and going, and particularly people who they deem to be suspicious, they'll be tracking them more closely.
And then they'll marry that information with what people do online?
That's right. The police cloud is the concept, which is the sort of big data concept, which looks at criminal activity or suspicious activity. But bear in mind, in China, criminal or suspicious activity also includes criticizing the government. So the police cloud is the big data aspect of it. And then social credit goes even one step further than that. That's, again, being piloted. But that would assign everybody a score showing how trustworthy they are. That would include financial credit information, which is a standard kind of credit rating that we have in the West. But it would also include the sort of things that people evaluate you online. Are you a good customer online? Have you paid your bills on time is one thing, but have you paid your traffic fines on time? And again, whether you criticize the government online, that could also affect your social credit score. My colleague was just on a train from Tianjin to Beijing the other day, and they announced that if people misbehaved or, you know, didn't follow the rules on the train, that would impact their credit scores. Every infringement, you run a red light, that can impact your credit score.
And this is going to be rolled out countrywide?
It's being piloted all around the country in lots of different ways and lots of different forms. Nobody can see a credit score right now from the government. There are some private sector credit scores, which are more sort of financial kind of credit scores, which may get integrated into this in the future. But certainly the idea of scoring people is being operated, is being used. And just to add, the sharp end of this actually is that your social credit score will determine access to services. So according to the way this is set out, if you have a low social credit score, you wouldn't be able to book first class train travel. You wouldn't be able to stay in a starred hotel. You potentially wouldn't be able to get a passport. And that is already happening. We're already seeing people who are on a blacklist of not having, say, paid court fines on time, a blacklist issued of millions of people whose rights to do that kind of thing would be affected. So step out of line in any of these spheres, as I say, from running a red light to failing to pay back a loan to criticizing the government, and you could find when you try and buy your train ticket that the machine says, sorry, you can't do this.
Oh my gosh. This sounds like an episode of Black Mirror. It doesn't sound real yeah. in a certain sense. But so what is the reaction? What did Chinese people think about all this?
So the initial sort of reaction, I mean, to the extent that Chinese people are aware about it, because the coverage in Chinese media, which is obviously state controlled, has been quite limited, or very limited, actually, and certainly not really kind of explaining the full impact of it. So the initial reaction of most people is sort of not really interested. They're quite complacent about it. And there's this kind of idea that, oh, it'll only get the bad guys. People sort of still have some kind of trust that the government won't make mistakes, or you won't suddenly find an error and you can't do anything about it. And this has already happened. We've already seen some isolated cases of people who said, I did pay the loan back. It just wasn't registered. And now my credit score has been affected and, you know, I can't do anything about it. So you're already sort of having those kind of problems. And of course, what happens to people is they don't really internalize it until it happens to them. But having said that, there is a little bit of concern just coming out recently about privacy. There is some big concern being expressed about whether the amount of data that Chinese citizens are handing over to private companies is then accessible to the government, and whether those private companies should be actually handing all of this information over to the government.
Well, right. So you have a kind of a crazy example of cameras in toilets monitoring whether or not people are stealing toilet paper.
Right. That's the kind of the gimmicky end of it. You know, the stuff that probably got some of the initial headlines with those kinds of ideas. There was a camera put on a female student's dormitory in Beijing to monitor who comes and goes, to check that no male guests were allowed to infiltrate the dormitory. There was a university lecturer who said he was going to use facial recognition to check whether his students were bored or not. You know, those kind of little gimmicky things initially kind of amused people, but the reality actually is far more all-encompassing and far more scary. So, and these Chinese tech companies are really intricately involved in designing this, and the way they describe it to me, they were saying, you know, the government might know a particular location is a location where gambling takes place. So they might see your face go to that location three times, and then you become a suspicious person. But then the people you associate with also become suspicious people. You know, that's where it really gets scary. Somebody is a dissident, they criticize the government. The people who they associate with then become people of interest and concern to the government too. It really does go down from toilet paper stuff right down to the nitty-gritty of, is it good to be friends with a dissident? What does it mean if you're related to somebody who's critical of the government?
Yeah, and then what happens if you're caught talking to a journalist such as yourself? So do you worry that this will make your job harder?
I'm sure it will make our jobs harder, but the government's quite good at making our jobs harder anyway.
Right.
The strange reality, I was just out today interviewing Chinese villagers who've lost their jobs because the war on pollution, there'd been a lot of environmental checkups and a lot of factories closed down. And actually, the funny thing about Chinese people, if you go out into the countryside, is they're actually quite open in a way about, you know, their grievances. They actually come and tell you, I've lost my job and I'm suffering and I can't deal with this. You know, why are the factories run by the rich people still pumping out the fumes, and you've closed down all the small factories. So people do still talk, but I do think that it will make it harder for people to give broader opinions. I mean, academics already facing a lot of problems in talking to journalists, NGOs, any kind of activist. You know, they're already facing the potential for arrest. It is going to make it harder to get experts to actually talk on the record or people who are involved, yeah.
Are there any American or Western tech companies involved in this?
Not directly in this at this stage that I've come across. This is more of a Chinese thing. I mean, the only involvement, if you like, is that Chinese people have studied in U.S. colleges and worked in U.S. companies like Microsoft or Google or places like that. So they did some time over in Silicon Valley, say, and then have come back to China to front this up. And actually, some of them have been sort of actively lured, if you like, back to China to front this or to set it up. You know, there is venture capital money in these tech companies that are driving the facial recognition software, but the government is very keen to harness all of these technologies for economic reasons, partly, but also because they see the value of these technologies in achieving this goal of sort of total surveillance.
You know, you mentioned CCTV at the outset, and of course that's a reference to cameras in Britain. That's what they're called, CCTV, and they're everywhere in London, right?
Yes.
And, you know, we obviously have financial credit monitoring, and we have our credit scores that either allow us or prevent us from buying a house or anything else along those lines. We have facial recognition technology. We have people erroneously put on do not fly lists. So, I mean, when you take all those data points that occur in the West quite regularly and have been for years, there seem to be some parallels.
Absolutely. I think that everybody in the world should be aware of the power of these technologies to track you, but also ultimately the fact that it's not transparent. As you say, people can have their credit scores affected by mistakes or put on no-fly lists. And it's very hard to correct that once a computer says you're a suspect. China is taking it further. It's putting it together in a way which is particularly sort of dystopian and sinister. And it has the really sort of explicit goal of including dissidents and people who are critical of the government in the list of people who are suspect or worth closely monitoring. So there are aspects which make China scarier and more advanced, but I think that all citizens in the world should be aware of the power of these technologies to track them and the amount of information which they put online. I mean, one's location is easily findable through, you know, your mobile phone at all times, which means that the Chinese police know where you are at all times, but it's not just the Chinese police who know that. Mm-hmm. So it should be a concern for everybody all around the world.
Yeah. I mean, you do have, like, for example, here, Black Lives Matter activists being monitored by the police and being tracked via their cell phones.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are more checks and balances in the West in terms of requiring some kind of approval. But as Edward Snowden showed, there is a lot going on that we're not told about and that we ought to have been told about.
Simon Denyer, China Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A 10-day festival of modern performance art launches tomorrow. It's called Live Art LA LA. It's part of Pacific Standard Time. There will be 25 different locations around LA hosting these performances. More than 200 performers, including artists and ensembles from 15 Latin American countries. And most importantly, Carolina Miranda is here to tell us about some of these shows and artists. She writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times. Hi there.
Hello, Madeline.
All right. This is being sponsored by Red Cat. This is that contemporary art space that CalArts runs in the Disney Concert Hall. And tell us what the overall theme is.
Well, this is once again keeping with the theme of Pacific Standard Time, which is looking at artists doing work in Latino artists in the U.S. and Latin American artists as well. But this brings us the, and this is something that was missing from the previous Pacific Standard Times in an organized way was performance art has been such an important part of the contemporary art tradition, you know, dating back to the 60s and 70s, even previous to that. And this was a way to do it, you know, all together as its own festival, that with previous exhibitions, there might be a performance tied to a show at LACMA or to something at the Hammer. But this was a way of organizing it so that we could really focus on what artists here and in Latin America are producing.
Okay, let's look at some of the highlights or some examples. One is Astrid Haddad, and she has a show tomorrow night at the Mayan Theater downtown.
And she does. I'm going to go to it. Astrid is a fascinating figure. She really came of age artistically in the 1980s, and she's not just a performance artist. She's part cabaret act, Mexican folkloric act, performance art. She makes fun of machismo. She takes on issues of feminism, and she styles herself in these very, what can only be described as these very hyper Mexican ways. If you go on YouTube and you look at some of her outfits, it's all very Mexican, very Aztec, in very exaggerated, almost cartoonish ways. And so she is doing a special performance at the Mayan tomorrow evening of this kind of cabaret performance type act that she does.
Okay, so here's a song that she has performed in the past, and I don't know if this will be in her show tomorrow night. It's called El Calcetín, or The Sock.
Como si fuera un calcetín. Ay, tírame cuando esté rota. Que en las cosas del amor, que en las cosas del amor, no hay manera.
Okay, what is she saying there?
It's an absolutely hilarious song where she's taking on the Mexican ballad tradition and telling this song. It's telling the story about being abandoned like a sock, you know, that I'm broken, I have holes, and now I'm being abandoned. So using the sock as a metaphor for being abandoned by a lover. And again, sort of taking these elements of Mexican identity and playing with them in a humorous way, exaggerating them. Ballads can be these very melodramatic forms. Musical forms in Latin America and Mexico as well. And so she's taking that and she's just caffeinating it.
Okay.
And so a very funny song with a hilarious video if you look it up.
Okay, good. So that's Astrid Haddad playing tomorrow night at
The Mayan.
Sylvia Palacios Whitman, she's Chilean, but she's been living in New York for a very long time, and she will be performing in LA for the very first time.
Exactly. This was an artist who I think really came to light to LA audiences as part of the Radical Women exhibition at the Hammer, which looked at art and feminism and women in Latin America from the 60s to the 80s. And she is an artist who makes these playful, wry objects that she uses in these performances that are a little surreal, a little dreamlike. So a giant set of hands, or it might be a staircase that she wears and kind of occupies a room in. It's like she takes these everyday elements and distorts them and exaggerates them in these very sort of dryly comical ways. And this is the first time she's in Los Angeles. I've never been able to see her perform, so I'm very excited about this show.
Okay, that's tomorrow night and Saturday at the Red Cat.
Yes.
Carmina Escobar, she's doing a performance at the Echo Park Lake on Saturday afternoon.
Carmina is terrific, and anybody in LA who hasn't heard her should definitely get to the show. She's an experimental vocalist originally from Mexico. Now she's based here, teaches at Cal Arts, and does a lot of very unusual things. And this is actually a reprise of a performance that she had done previously on Echo Park Lake for Machine Project, in which she performs on this floating platform around the lake over the course of a day. And so she is accompanied by a Japanese buto dancer on another platform, and then there's a Oaxacan brass band, a youth band, that kind of parades through the park and leads people to her performance. And she stands on this platform with these giant wooden megaphones, and she has these very sort of abstracted, almost bird-like sounding, I don't want to say lyrics because they're not lyrics, but sounds that she makes. And so it's something that plays with the idea of what the park is and what you might hear in a park, but also makes it kind of surreal, like you're seeing this apparition, this woman that kind of floats in on this raft on the lake.
Wow.
It's fantastic.
That sounds great. So that's Saturday afternoon from 1 to 5.
Yes.
At the Echo Park Lake. Okay, yes. One more. Artist Rafa Esparza, he is doing a show called Cumbre, Look As Far As You Can See in Every Direction, North and South, East and West.
Yes. Rafa is a very important LA artist, born and raised. And a lot of his work plays with issues or takes on issues, really, really of indigenous identity, of masculinity, of male sexuality, of colonialism. He has long maintained aspects of indigenous tradition in his work, so elements of Aztec dancing and Aztec costuming. But then he has historically performed them in these very LA locations, you know, under freeways or on the side of the LA River. He's done projects in which he makes adobe bricks with water and mud from the LA River and has used them to build installation. One of them, a huge installation that he did at LACE a couple of years back. And so an artist that is taking the Mexican and the traditional and using it to touch on contemporary themes of sexuality in the city and land.
And this will be at the Geffen on Saturday the 21st.
Yes. So it's a full roster.
Full roster.
Lots of, I have a booked schedule ahead for the next 10 days.
Okay, so you can check it out online, check out all the performances.
Yes, redcat.org has all the listings.
Okay, and it runs through January 21st. Starts tomorrow.
Starts tomorrow through January 21st.
All right. Carolina Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, also a regular contributor here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Christian Bordahl here to round out the show with some listener feedback. Hi.
Yeah, well, yesterday we talked about how Republican Congressman Ed Royce wouldn't be seeking re-election. Today we find out and talked about the fact that Daryl Issa, says he's not going to be running in November either. Blazin' Tommy D says, oh dear, I'm crushed, with a little ironic smiley face. Mr. Ed, the original stable genius, laughs, says, ha ha ha, this guy knows he won't win re-election, but there's plenty of work for him lobbying Congress for the wealthiest and corporations. Kyle Kondik at the UVA Center for Politics says that ICE's retirement is moving that district from a toss-up to leaning Democratic. You also talked about this incredible total surveillance system that China is creating with millions of security cameras following everyone using facial recognition software. Sherry Ray Vaughn wrote in that this is just like a movie from 2015 called Everything Before Us. I've never heard of that, but in that movie, apparently the Department of Emotional Integrity documents all relationship activity and a relationship score is given to keep people accountable for their choices. So I guess, people have been thinking about this stuff already.
Yeah, and we don't need to watch a movie because we're living it.
The social credit score is a thing about that story that just freaked me out.
Social credit
score. I'm not sure what my social credit score would be.
Better not find out.
No, exactly. No.
Okay. All right. Christian Bordahl, thank you very much. Sure. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.